You're listening to Beyond the Ribbon, a podcast of the Cancer Survivorship Center, powered by 24 Hours in the Canyon. This podcast is brought to you by Auto Inc. Auto Inc. is a distinguished family of dealerships redefining automotive excellence. Be sure to check out their website at autoinc.com. Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of Beyond the Ribbon. My name is Ryan Parnell, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host and oncology nurse, Pam McMillan.
Ryan, we're back for another great episode. Are you ready?
I am, Pam. I really am.
I'm always excited to record a new episode and learn from our guest. You know, cancer survivors go through so much.
Yes.
And I don't know how they feel. I can't relate, but I know that there's help out there. And so I hope that those that are listening, if you're struggling, make sure that you reach out. We have some wonderful people to talk to. We have wonderful resources. But, you know, with cancer comes some maybe stress.
Maybe.
I mean, I would think. I don't know. But, you know, I'm eager to learn about cancer-related post-traumatic stress disorder. How about you?
Absolutely. And, you know, the thing about it is we never profess to say, like, we have all the answers.
No.
But we have become very good at finding someone or going to someone and getting that help for folks that need it.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, that leads us again to today's episode, as you said, on cancer-related post-traumatic stress disorder. And we're super excited to have an old friend back, right?
Yes. One of our friends.
I know. Liz Clark is joining us. Liz, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You know, Liz was with us for a number of years. You may have heard her on the podcast a few times. And Liz is a licensed professional counselor here in Amarillo. And we're just super excited because she does have some specializations in PTSD. So let's talk about that.
Yes, let's do that.
Well, first, let's talk about how long were you with us? Do you remember?
So I was with the Survivorship Center, I think 5 to 6 years. Mm-hmm. I provided individual psychotherapy for cancer survivors, adults and children, and I also helped facilitate the support group.
Yeah. And then her private practice just blossomed and just took off.
She has a few kids that are busy and life happens and... And but you're still our friend.
And we promised we were going to pull her back in, didn't we? I remember that. I was like, we're not letting you go forever. So we're super glad that you found time to fit us in and really give back a little bit again to our folks on one of your specializations, which is PTSD.
Yes. I'm so happy to be here.
So can you just start with the basics and explain to our listeners, what is PTSD?
Well, post-traumatic stress really and the simplest terms is anything that overwhelms the nervous system. So we are already wired with a God-given ability to survive difficult things. And when we go through something that's potentially life-threatening, our nervous system will activate in order to give us the greatest potential for survival. So a lot of times we think about that activation as a fight or flight mechanism, which prepares us for action to do something. Or we could consider it a freeze mechanism, which prepares us to endure something difficult. So the difference between fight and flight and freeze is really the difference between can I act or do I need to buckle down and endure the hard thing? Well, post-traumatic stress happens when those mechanisms don't disengage or they become more sensitive, meaning I am more easily activated into fight or flight because of triggering things that remind me of that life threat. Or I'm more likely to shut down when stress hits. So normally when we experience something difficult, our nervous system will activate, but it will naturally deactivate. So we go back to a normal baseline and we continue on life as normal. But in post-traumatic stress, our system activates and remains engaged. So now everything just feels a little bit harder.
So what's the difference between PTSD, anxiety, depression? How do you know which one you have?
Wow. Okay. So that's a loaded question.
Way to go, Pam. Right off the bat.
Well, you know, it really depends on contributing factors. We want to look at the whole picture. We want to look at the history. So anxiety, we could say, is also an overactive nervous system, but there's not necessarily a contributing traumatic event in anxiety. It could happen without contributing trauma. It could be as part of a chronic mental illness. somebody with post-traumatic stress disorder who is stuck in a state of fight or flight will appear anxious. A lot of the times the symptoms will mimic each other, but the course of treatment might be entirely different. So we have to take into account the person's whole history and their experience so we can give honor to the things that are causing the symptoms. When somebody is stuck in a state or more sensitive to a freeze response, that's going to mimic depression. So sometimes on the surface, it will look exactly the same. But if we look at their history and we see that there's a traumatic event that's affecting them, then we want to make sure we go back and we honor that story so that they can have the best quality of life possible. The way that we treat the symptoms is going to be different.
So I'm guessing there's some misdiagnosis out there for cancer patients, because I would think that you would be very anxious and you could be very depressed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, mental health diagnosis is not always an exact science, because all we're going off of is symptoms. Typically, you know, with cancer, you can see it. You see it in the biology. Sometimes when somebody's suffering from a mental health disorder, we can't always see exactly what's happening. So we have to be very thorough in the way that we assess an individual so that we're giving their symptoms the best possible care.
So when you talk about symptoms of post-traumatic stress, what should we be looking for? What are some of those?
Okay. So what we are looking for, we're looking for the overactivation of the nervous system. Sometimes what we're going to see is anxiety type symptoms, hyperarousal symptoms. So somebody might be hypervigilant. They are more sensitive to sensory input and they're constantly looking for signs of threat. There also would be avoidance of triggers, people, places, things that might cause them to remember the event itself. You're also going to see an impact on their mood. So leaning more towards a negative affect, feelings of powerlessness or helplessness, hopelessness. Those are some of the symptoms that can be misdiagnosed as depression. You also might have intrusive symptoms, so flashbacks or nightmares. So these would be intrusions where somebody starts to re-experience as if they're reliving the event itself. And then you have dissociative symptoms. So dissociative symptoms would be symptoms where we feel like we are detached from our physical being, where maybe I feel numb, or I feel like I'm watching myself from outside of myself, that I'm not really present in my body. There might be a lack of feeling, a lack of emotion in dissociative symptoms as well, and a lack of ability to connect with other people.
Wow. That's a lot.
It is a lot.
And I can see how, just based off of that right there, how you said there's potential for misdiagnosis or potential for maybe going down a path that may be something totally different.
Right. Right.
What if one of our listeners are out there and I'm thinking, yeah, that's me. What's the first step to get help?
Well, I think one of the biggest factors that's going to give people symptom relief is their supportive environment. So it's also the support that we receive around an event tends to be the number one determining factor on how severe the symptoms that we experience are later. And so having a supportive environment, whether it's leading up to the event, during, or after the event. So finding supportive people. The other thing I would say would be connecting to resources that maybe are a little bit more clinical. Sometimes that might mean getting medication support so that you can return to a better quality of life, so that you can get out of bed in the morning. That certainly has its place. And then also psychotherapy or therapeutic support to process some of the traumatic information that is essentially stuck in the nervous system.
You talk about triggers. You mentioned that. And I know there's... That's a key word, right, in this, and it senses things. What are some of those triggers that might, like, trigger, if you will, these post-traumatic stress disorders?
Right. Well, so triggers, they can be very subtle or they can be very overt, really. So like a very clear trigger would be a follow-up appointment. Mm-hmm. Or having some kind of imaging done, like a CT scan, where this is very much linked to the traumatic event of the diagnosis and the treatment itself. And so that we say, oh, that's an obvious trigger. I remember when I was doing the support group, there was a term called scanxiety, mm-hmm, that some of the survivors would use to describe that feeling of dread when they had to do a follow-up appointment. So sometimes they can be very clear. Sometimes they're more subtle. It could be the smell I know during COVID, I worked with a couple of survivors who were triggered by seeing masks on everybody. I had somebody specifically come to counseling because their post-traumatic stress was triggered by seeing all of their coworkers in masks. And that's not something that we would necessarily consider unless you had gone through it yourself. Right. And so it could be a smell, it could be a location, you know, driving by a certain location. It could be a TV show that you watched in the hospital. You know, it could be a number of things.
So very individualistic.
Very individualized. And a trigger is essentially something that causes your nervous system to react as though it's happening again. So it's not just something that bothers you or annoys you. It's something that activates you physically to the point where you do not feel safe in your body.
So knowing your triggers are very important.
Yeah. And sometimes it's hard to know what they are.
Right.
And it may be impossible to avoid.
Right. Right. Absolutely. You know, if you have to receive ongoing medical care because you're a cancer survivor, you don't get the privilege of avoiding your triggers.
Right.
Like other people with post-traumatic stress might be able to do.
Ryan, I remember at our previous employer, the popcorn.
Yeah.
How many people were triggered by the smell of popcorn?
I was thinking the exact same thing. Not to mention when they burnt the popcorn, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
But I just felt so sad because some folks, when they would come in and smell the popcorn, it was rough.
It was. You could see it on them. Like it really disturbed them.
And I can totally understand how something like that is very powerful. And not being able to avoid it because you got to come there for treatment.
Right.
Right.
So how do you deal with that? I mean, you can't avoid going to the treatment center. You can't avoid going to get those scans. What can you do for yourself to prepare yourself for those things?
Man, that's a really hard question. You know, symptoms are not a matter of will. So I think sometimes there's this idea that if you know what your triggers are, you should be able to just will yourself through them, that you should be able to snap out of it or just tolerate it somehow. And really, symptoms aren't controlled by me just willing myself through it. And so I want to be really careful here not to suggest that there are things that people could do to relieve their symptoms, because it just doesn't always work that well or that easy. So one of the things that we would aim to do in the beginning of post-traumatic stress treatment is we talk a lot about self-compassion. There's a woman, Kristen Neff, her whole body of research is around self-compassion. She has a website, it's self-compassion.org. But we want people to have compassion for the suffering that they experience, right? To not judge themselves too harshly for being affected by this traumatic thing that they went through. So that would be part of it. And then the goal of treating post-traumatic stress would be helping the nervous system return to a normal baseline. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying normal with air quotes.
Yeah.
Helping the nervous system return to a close to normal baseline, a pre-trauma baseline, as much as we are able, so that their nervous system is not as reactive to some of those sensory inputs. Right. And that's not always something that can, you know, we don't power through that. We have specific ways that we try to treat that, whether it's through medication or it's through something like EMDR, eye movement desensitization or reprocessing. And so really, to summarize, it would be, we want to help people be kind internally in the way that they think about themselves and their symptoms. We want to reframe cognitions in the healthiest way that we are able. And then we want to help the body return to a state of normal functioning to the best of our ability.
I can't help but think back to one of the podcasts that we've referenced several times. The previous mayor of Amarillo,
right.
She talked about give yourself grace, you know, and give yourself some, it's okay to kind of thing.
Right.
Like I need to take a break, give yourself some grace. It's okay to do it.
Right.
And so is that kind of goes right along with self-compassion.
Yeah, that's part of the self-compassion. You know, self-compassion is really, how do you respond to your own suffering? And if we were to ask the survivors, I think most of them would say that they are able to express deep compassion for their colleagues and their companions on this journey. And that's something I observed when I would facilitate the group. But sometimes they are much harder on themselves. And so one way to think about self-compassion is, if you had a friend or a family member who was walking through this, what would you tell them? What would you tell them? Chances are you wouldn't say, hey, get over it.
Right.
You know, you wouldn't say that to somebody that you loved, but sometimes we say that to ourselves. We're harsh to ourselves. We think that we need to just be able to function like we did before, when really that's not realistic.
Right. I think we are our worst enemies.
We are. Mm-hmm. We are. I think every one of us would agree with that, for sure. For sure. You know, it seems like, and you've touched on this, but it seems like a lot of times we as a society are looking for a quick fix.
Yeah.
Right. And mm-hmm. so you've mentioned medication, but I don't know if our listeners have picked up on it's like medication so that you can do this. It's not just medication to fix this.
Right.
So, you know, you mentioned medication so that you can get out of bed and function for the day, but it's not like this is the fix and it's, you know, you're going to take 30 days of this and be done.
Right. Yeah. It's nuanced, and we want to be, balanced in our approach. So, and I'm not an MD, so I don't prescribe medication, but what I want people to understand is that the goal sometimes, whether it's a chronic mental illness or post-traumatic stress, or, you know, when it comes to mental health, sometimes the goal is to tolerate the thing, the hard thing, versus to fix the hard thing. You know, what resources do we have available to help you walk through this hard thing? Because we know that we can't make it go away. And sometimes we need medication support to help us manage the symptoms that we're experiencing so that we can participate in life. But we know that that's not going to fully resolve the symptoms that we experience. You know, and sometimes we need people, we need purpose, we need joy. And sometimes we need clinical support through something like therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And community.
Absolutely. Community is huge.
Right. You know, and she said medication support. It's another thing that I think it was like, but it's great. You know, it's like, okay, it helps, but this also is other areas that can be beneficial.
Right.
One thing I think I would like to ask you about, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about the cancer survivor. What about caregivers?
Well, I believe caregivers are vulnerable to post-traumatic stress, much in the same way that cancer survivors are. If you look at the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder in the DSM, one of the qualifying characteristics is that there is some kind of traumatic event, but you do not have to be the person involved in the event. It could be that it was a loved one, or it could be that you witnessed some kind of traumatic event. And so witnessing a loved one move through something as devastating as cancer could make you vulnerable to post-traumatic stress, much in the same way that they're vulnerable to post-traumatic stress. Now, obviously the experiences are completely different, but I believe that caregivers and loved ones are vulnerable as well and in need of support.
What about the kiddos?
Like the children of mm-hmm. survivors or the parents?
The children of patients that have cancer.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, one of the things that people will experience when they experience a traumatic event is a loss of power, mm-hmm. A loss of autonomy, a loss of control over my future.
Absolutely.
And so you're going to, and then also isolation is a big one as well. And so if your caregiver is not able to care for you in the same way, this is going to have an impact. Not because the caregiver is doing anything wrong, but because they're trying to survive the very hard thing that they're going through, the cancer diagnosis and the treatment. And I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind when we're talking to family members is, and to survivors, is it's not a you versus them thing. It's a, okay, everybody in the family is fighting against the same hard thing on the same team.
I think that would be very hard to get on the same page.
Especially when you, as you mentioned, Pam, especially if there's children involved, especially if you have a large family, especially if everybody lives locally, all those factors, right? Everybody wants to pull and you're trying to get pulling in the same direction and doing things together.
Right, right. It's such a complicated issue and there are no easy answers, because something like this is going to affect the entire family system. And so you risk things like post-traumatic stress for family members and children, but there's also risks of burnout, compassion fatigue, mm-hmm. Maybe even resentments.
I can see that.
And so it's not an easy thing. And so the whole family system needs an abundance of support.
Yeah. Which
I think we have.
I mean, this is a great opportunity right there just to kind of push pause and say, we have support systems available. There are support systems available aside from what we have.
Right.
I mean, we're not saying we're the end all one most wonderful place, although we feel like we have a great place if you have to be here. But you know, support, whether it is a support group, whether it is speaking with a counselor, whether it's a chaplain, whether it's, you know, a group setting, whether it's individuals, I mean, we've got it.
We have a lot of options. You know, some people like that group support. Some people like that individualized. Some like the kids getting help, separate from the parents. So, you know, we have a lot of options. If you're struggling, make sure that you reach out at 806-331-2400.
Yeah. That's probably one of the hardest parts though, right? Making that decision to say, all right, I can't do it on my own. I need to reach out.
Yeah, I think it's very hard.
Like that breaking point. When is it time to call?
Before you think to. you know, I have
yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's a lot of times, and I don't know if this is a cultural thing, but it seems like we are collectively prone to calling only when we've reached the point of devastation versus how can we begin to use resources in a preventative way to prevent PTS from happening, to prevent post-traumatic stress from really taking hold. And the supports that we have while we're going through the trauma are going to make a huge impact on how we do later.
Right.
I think, yeah, I'm thinking of myself, you know, oh, I have a toothache. Oh, it's fine. Oh, it's fine. No, I'll be all
right. One morning you wake up and it's not fine.
And then you hit that breaking point. And that's a very good point, Liz, is to say, let's try to plug you in before you hit that breaking point. You know, just as a side note, every little thing that we do at the Cancer Survivorship Center is available to someone from the moment of their diagnosis. Even though we, you know, we say cancer survivor and we know, Pam, how many times have we had this discussion? We know people feel differently about that term.
Right.
Maybe I'm not a survivor until I'm 5 years out. Maybe I'm not a survivor until I finish chemo or until I finish radiation or whatever the case may be. Regardless, we consider you a survivor from the moment you are diagnosed.
You've heard you have cancer, you qualify.
That's right. And so, you know, we encourage you, you know, to, as you said, Liz, that's a great thing, is just to be so preventative and plug in and talk to someone, whether it's one of our counselors or at a support group. Find a community, which is what we like to think. We have a great community here at the center.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, one of the things I'll mention too is just because I don't want anybody to experience shame if they have done the things and still have symptoms. You can do everything right and still suffer from symptoms of post-traumatic stress because cancer really is just that devastating. And so making sure that we encourage people to seek resources, but we also want to validate the fact that this is just a hard thing. And sometimes it's going to impact us in ways that we hoped it wouldn't.
Liz, is there anything else that you would like to talk to our listeners about post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, so actually, yes. One of the thoughts that came to my mind when I was thinking about shame is there's this concept of non-traumatization as a privilege. So Jennifer Baldwin writes about this in her book. It's called Trauma-Sensitive Theology, I think is the name of the book. But this idea that, you know, it's really easy to assume if we're not suffering from cancer or post-traumatic stress or mental illness, that it's because we have superior character or we did something right. When in actuality, we just have the privilege of not having to worry about those things. And so if somebody is suffering from something that you're not suffering from, it's not because there's a difference in their integrity or character or willpower. It's just that, you know, maybe you were lucky. And so I just want to make it very clear that to our listeners who are suffering, that it's This is not about what you did or didn't do, or whether or not you sought help soon enough, or whether or not you're mentally strong. It's just sometimes we experience symptoms because our brains and bodies were designed to react to threat in a certain way. And now we are suffering from the psychological injury as a result of that threat. And those symptoms and those injuries deserve care.
Yeah. And I think that could also go towards Pam, how sometimes you see, I know we've seen it where someone comes to the center and they're like, no, I'm good. I really am good. Like I'm not making that up. I'm really good. And then you kind of go, okay, well, we're here, you know, and there's no judgment. It's like, you're good. You know, we're here if you need us. Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side, you have someone very similarly with the same similar diagnosis, et cetera, that is really struggling. And I think that's a very good point, Liz, to make, is that it's not that you did something wrong or right. You're just lucky.
Yeah. Well, and there's so many factors that affect our vulnerability, and those factors are not in our control. And they might include things like previous trauma. Mm-hmm. Or a previous diagnosis. You know, I imagine, and I don't know the research on this, but I imagine those who are diagnosed with cancer for the second time might be more vulnerable to post-traumatic stress because of the recurrence.
Makes sense.
But also the support system that we have, or what we experienced growing up, all of those things are going to impact our vulnerability.
You know, oftentimes I hear one of our counselors talk about, you know, sometimes it's not the cancer diagnosis that triggers it. It's all the other things mm-hmm. that they had to deal with in life.
Absolutely. It can be cumulative. And when trauma is cumulative, oftentimes we will refer to that as complex trauma because it's trauma on top of trauma on top of trauma. You know, if you've experienced a lifetime of powerlessness, this is just one more thing that feels out of control.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Wow.
A lot of information.
A lot to unpack. Yes. A lot to unpack. And I think it's important to talk about it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we want to bring these things to light. We want to shed some light. Pam, I remember one of the early on in our journey of the survivorship program, I'll never forget, and I remember you telling me this, that a lot of what you do is validation, you know, right. in talking, not a lot, but some of what you do is validation of it. This is normal and it's okay to feel this way.
Yes.
And
there's help out there.
There are Let's resources and some help. And I think that's what's most important about this is just saying, hey, listen, we're just shedding light. We're not pointing fingers. We want to help you and let you know that there are resources beyond us that are available to help. So I think it's important to share and to talk about this and not bury it deep down inside and not ever bring it up. You know, I think it's important that we continue to talk about these things.
Absolutely. Liz, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with our listeners. This brings us to our last segment. We are sponsored by the Auto Inc. family. Do you have an Auto Inc. inspiring moment you would like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I can reflect on the time here at the survivorship when I was lucky enough to facilitate the support group we did. I co-facilitated an emotional and spiritual support group. And one of the things that I was lucky enough to observe was how the survivors cared for each other. So I mentioned before, a lot of these survivors would have an abundance of compassion for their comrades in this group. And it got to the point where the group was it really could have been self-led because they had such love and care for each other. And so I view it as a blessing to be able to witness that process. And if you're somebody who feels isolated in your journey, I cannot recommend enough that group, that care group, because of the way that they are able to show up and love each other. And man, they would have knowledge about the cancer experience that I couldn't have. Like I don't have, because I'm not a cancer survivor myself. And so they were able to really build each other up and give feedback about their experiences. And it was a really cool thing to be able to witness.
It is.
You know, that reminds me of the article that I wrote about, you know, it's like the club you don't want to be a part of, but you do want to be a part of after you get that diagnosis.
Yeah.
Well, and what's unique about our support group is it's such a wide array of folks, newly diagnosed, been out of treatment for 10, 15 years, young, middle-aged, older. I mean, it is a true melting pot, if you will. And that's a unique situation too, because as you said, there's so much you can learn from folks that have been through this and walked your journey and are completely on the other end.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, it's that finding that community.
That is right. That is right. Liz, thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing just a bit with our folks. You know, if you're listening and you feel like this is you and you know, you need to talk to someone and need some help, we have, as we said, the resources. The one thing we didn't say is that, oh, by the way, we also have some resources like this through counseling that are virtual. And so you don't have to live in Amarillo. We recognize that, you know, we reach folks that come to Amarillo for treatment, but yet you live 2 hours away and you say, gosh, I can't go to counseling or I can't do. No, we can help you. We have some virtual options.
Yes. And you know, those virtual options are really nice if you only have an hour for lunch mm-hmm. and you can go to your car and have that session. So,
yeah, absolutely. Super flexible, super easy. And oh, by the way, we take care of the cost on that. It is 100% free of what we provide here at the Cancer Survivorship Center. Pam, this has been a great episode. I always love learning.
Yes.
And it's there's always something to learn. And I think this is a good topic to share with folks that you're walking through the journey with, you're going through, maybe a caregiver, a loved one. I think it's important to do that. Reach out if you need help, and then make sure you join us next time for another great episode of Beyond the Ribbon. Thanks again for listening to Beyond the Ribbon. We'd like to extend a special thanks to the Auto Inc. family of dealerships, as they have supported the 24 Hours in the Canyon Cancer Survivorship Center since 2016. For more information on the Cancer Survivorship Center, please visit our website at 24survivorship.org.